Tonight, an extended arena remembering the life and work of Poet Laureate Seamus Heaney.
Digging. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound when the spade sinks into gravelly ground. My father digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug. The shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf. Digging. The cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
Seamus Heaney reading his poem Digging from his debut collection, Death of a Naturalist, first published in 1966. We heard that from the RTE production in association with the Lannan Foundation as part of the celebrations for Seamus Heaney's 70th birthday in 2009, a 15-CD box set of the poet reading his own work. We'll be hearing lots from that over the next hour and a half. We'll be talking to fellow poets and friends with me in studio here in Dublin, Peter Sir, Pat Bourne, John F. Dean and Enda Wiley. And joining me from various studios and places around the world, lots of various poets and friends, including Paul Muldoon. We'll also be talking to Matthew Hollis, the poetry editor at Faber, and we'll start in the United States. In a few minutes we'll be talking to Anne Settlemyer, his great friend, but right now with me is Harold Bloom, Professor Harold Bloom of Yale University. Professor Bloom, when did Seamus Heaney's his work first come to your attention?
Oh, I started to read Seamus very early on. I think before there was actually a first published volume. But I didn't really begin to know the work well until Death of a Naturalist.
You then you edited a critical study of his work some years later. This was Seamus Heaney in 1986.
Yes, long before that, Seamus was perhaps too kind about this. I wrote a very long review essay on him for the TOS, the year that a field work came out, and it surveyed, perhaps there were five volumes of him, I may have the arithmetic wrong, culminating in field work, which I thought was even for him, a magnificent breakthrough, but even that, of course, could not approximate the tremendous, really Dantesque splendor of Station Island and the even later work. But he was kind enough to tell me that he thought that piece in the TOS had helped bring him a number of serious readers for me, valued very greatly. I introduced him at several poetry readings Yale, also in New York City. And I think occasionally we talked on the telephone, and we met two or three times. And like everyone else, I fell in love with his beautiful wife, Marie. And I feel immensely sorrowful. He was only 74. I am now 83. 74 for a great poet, surely the greatest Anglo-Irish poet since the death of William Butler Yeats in 1939. 74. Much too young an age, there would have been.
You make a comparison, Professor Bloom, when you were speaking there about Station Island. I think you mentioned Dante-esque. Where would you place him in the pantheon of great poets, Seamus Heaney?
Difficult as yet to see him in the longest perspective, and in the end these matters are settled not by individual critics or even by any particular age, but by scores of years, perhaps centuries. He is a permanent poet. There's no question about that. I would have said that at the time of his unfortunate leaving us, the only two poets in English who fully were his equals were the great American poet, John Ashbery. John is now, let's see, if I'm 83, John is 86. And, of course, Geoffrey Hill in England. I'm not quite sure how old Mr. Hill is at this point. I would think perhaps in his early 60s, perhaps a bit older. But he had, his work had the kind of authority, the sense of augmenting the foundations of poetry itself that one finds in the best work of Geoffrey Hill and of John Ashbery. Where does one place him finally? He does not much resemble William Butler Yeats. And I don't think he felt, not exactly to coin an expression, any anxiety of influence in regard to Yeats, though he was charming enough to say to me that he occasionally felt it. But it's not that sense of singing score that he takes over from the Byzantium poems is Yeatsian, but his vision is not Yeatsian. It is not occult.
I suppose there's a much more earthy quality to it.
It's sublime, not by way, ultimately, of the high romantics, as William Butler Yeats did, but in terms of older traditions. One of his great things, which still astonishes me, I've used it occasionally for teaching purposes, is the magnificent version of Beowulf. But the quality that one feels of an almost direct inheritance from Dante in Station Island and afterwards reminds me of Shelley's The Triumph of Life, though I doubt that that was a poem that meant so particularly much to Seamus.
Well, Harold Bloom, thank you, of Yale University, thank you so much for sharing some of your thoughts with us this evening. Also on the line, I think from the United States as well this evening, is one of Seamus Heaney's friends, Anne Saddlemyre, a critic and J.M. Singh scholar herself. Anne, maybe you would tell me a little bit about Glanmore Cottage, which I think may have been an old gamekeeper's house at the Singh estate close to Ashford in County Wicklow, but became important in Seamus Heaney's life in the early 70s.
Yes. Though first I must say that I'm Canadian. I speak from Canada.
I do beg your pardon.
That's quite all right. And I first met Seamus in the 60s when he was actually reading in Canada and the West Coast. But I got to know him better when the Singh Centenary was taking place in 1971 in Ireland, and we met again in Belfast. And then shortly afterwards, when I myself was the owner of Glanmore Cottage and had moved to Toronto and was consequently extremely busy with my new job, my new position, that I realized that much as I loved Glanmore, I was simply not going to be able to give it the attention I should. And about that time, coincidentally, I heard that Seamus and Mary were considering moving out of Belfast so that Seamus could commit himself and his life to writing. So I wrote and said, would they like to come and live in Glanmore Cottage? And from then on, I saw them frequently every time I was in Ireland, and elsewhere, and Glanmore became Seamus's place of writing. as he called it himself, a very important place where he could, a refuge where he could go and concentrate on the writing.
In fact, wasn't it in Glanmore
Cottage?
Wasn't in Glanmore Cottage where he first actually expressed the idea that he was a poet? It was the first time he said that to himself.
Yes. He, and I think this is really what was the strongest bond between us. Though of course, friendship was, you can't limit friendship to any restricted to any particular place, but Glanmore became something very special in that sense to Seamus, and therefore to me, because of my great admiration for his work and for him as a person.
At what point, or during that time, did he express to you any trepidation, Anne, about this whole idea of becoming a poet and what that meant, the responsibilities that that would be and would cause him to have to take on?
Yes, I mean, he was, of course, nervous about it, hesitant, but also committed. And he did speak of it as a commitment, and that would take precedence over any other work he might do. Commitment as an employee, he once said when he was teaching. But he was naturally uneasy about it. And there was the whole business of raising a family, keeping a family comfortable and happy. Mary has always been the strongest force in his life. And without her support, that none of that could have happened. But they came down with two small sons. The daughter, Catherine Ann, was then born when they were at Glanmore. And this was responsibility that Seamus, of all people, would take very seriously. And that was the life around him as well as his internal life.
I want to listen to Seamus' voice again at this point, if I could, Anne. And you have chosen for us the poem The Skylight from Seeing Things, which is 1991 collection. I suppose really the middle of the career. Maybe you'd briefly tell us why you've chosen this and then we'll hear Seamus Heaney read it.
The last time I saw Seamus and Mary was 2 years ago when I was in Dublin and he came to my lecture. And invited me, was insistent that I come down to Glanmore and see the renovations that had taken place. When they first lived in it, it couldn't have been easy at all for Mary. I mean, the kitchen itself was just a sort of attached to the cottage. There were no great luxuries or comforts about it. But over the years, things changed and they improved things. And one of the things that was most important, one of the spaces in the cottage, was Seamus's place of writing, his room upstairs, which was enclosed, warm, and comforting in its sense of enclosure. But Mary had always insisted that there wasn't enough light there, and she was quite right. And so the poem begins in an address, as so many of his poems do, in an address to Mary about her insistence that there be a skylight. But he was very worried about what I would feel, since I was very much part of Glanmore as well. So this last visit, just 2 years ago, was really to show me what had been done. And one of the things that had been done was to create a skylight. But the poem tells it all.
7. The Skylight. You were the one for skylights. I opposed cutting into the seasoned tongue and groove of pitch pine. I liked it low and closed, its claustrophobic nest-up-in-the-roof effect. I liked the snuff-dry feeling, the perfect trunk-lid fit of the old ceiling. Under there, It was all hutch and hatch. The blue slates kept the heat like midnight thatch. But when the slates came off, extravagant sky entered and held surprise wide open. For days I felt like an inhabitant of that house where the man, sick of the palsy, was lowered through the roof, had his sins forgiven, was healed, took up his bed and walked away.
Seamus Heaney with The Skylight from his collection Seeing Things. You're listening to an Arena special. We're with you until 8:30 this evening, looking at the work and life of Poet Laureate Seamus Heaney, who died earlier today. And that was indeed the choice of Anne Saddlemyre as one of the poems that particularly meant something to her. With me in studio this evening, Peter Sir, Pat Bourne, John F. Dean and Enda Wiley. Peter, if I can come to you first. You wrote, in fact, for the CD collection that we're listening to this evening, you wrote the introductory essay for that. And you talk in that essay, I think quite early on, about the materiality. I can't remember the adjective you used, but the materiality, particularly in the early poems. But we get that real grounded and earthed feel even in that poem, The Skylight. It's very much a real man talking about real life.
No, I think that is very true. It's one of the things that we go to Heaney for. I mean, it's the way in which he makes the real world visible to us in these kind of dense stacks of textured language that he does. It's a thing I always go back to. It's like a notion of pleasure in a way, that there's just the great sonic pleasure that you get from the sounds that his work makes, and the way that he kind of draws you in, lures you in to the work. And it's the work. It's the world of, you know, memory bringing him back to the things of his childhood. You know, the kind of the agricultural implements, the sofas, the kitchen, the kind of clock ticking in the kitchen. You know, so everything is there and is evoked in this kind of astonishing kind of vivid manner. You know,
particularly I think that it's true in the earlier collections, in particular 1966, Death of a Naturalist, that we heard digging from that earlier on. Door into the Dark came then in 1969, and we heard Fieldwork being mentioned by Harold Bloom. Do you see, if you like, big phases in the career of Seamus Heaney? Was there those early pastoral poems, the political in the middle, and where did it go to in the final sections?
Yeah, it's kind of tricky. I mean, it's complicated in many respects. I mean, yes, you might look, the early work seems, maybe The Death of a Naturalist, Door into the Dark, seems to belong to a kind of almost Wordsworthian pastoral world of you know, emotion recollected in tranquility and nature and apprehended in that way, and then suddenly a kind of unease starts to creep in, you know, around, you know, the great central kind of collections of the 70s, like Wintering Out and North and Fieldwork, that Harold Bloom mentioned there as one of the high points. I certainly agree that one of the high points of his work. And that's also coinciding with the increase in the kind of conflagration of the North, and also of the whole kind of realm of expectations that brought upon him as a poet, the kind of expectation that he would somehow be more than a poet, but be a Vatic kind of spokesman for a particular tribe. And then the feeling that if he wasn't doing that, that he was letting his side down. And so, I mean, he starts to try and deal with all of that, sometimes reaching back into history, like reaching back into the Iron Age kind of sacrificial bog victims, and trying to find comparisons between that and what was going on, say, in the North.
Yeah, which we get in North, the collection came
all
in 1975.
Of that, absolutely, yeah. So there is that. I mean, he's always, there's an uneasiness about him. You know, I mean, he's not a kind of, you know, he's never a cuddly poet. I mean, he's kind of poised in between, you know, the kind of the celebratory thing is important, but it's always mixed in with this kind of uncertainty and self-questioning. He's always kind of poised between those two poles, I think. So there's an edginess always about the work.
John F. Dean, people often refer to you as one of the nature poets, or as nature being a very important part of your poetry as well. Would Heaney have influenced you in that direction?
It's very hard to know where the influences come from. I think it would have been Heaney, but through Kavanagh, and Kavanagh through Hopkins. So Heaney, Kavanagh, Hopkins would have kind of stirred me in the whole nature thing. But I had been actually writing poems about the west of Ireland before I came in contact with Seamus at all. And in fact, I began to try and publish a little journal way, way back around 1968, 69. And Seamus had become well known through Death of a Naturalist. And I wrote to him, foolishly, but I got a generous answer, as everybody, I think, always did from Seamus Heaney. And he said, well, I have two poems here that you can use if you like. You mightn't like them, you mightn't think they're any good. This to a young upstart from the west of Ireland. And there were two poems that appeared actually shortly after that in North, Mossbond Sunlight, and the other one, I forget the title of it. So I became enamoured of Seamus as a gentleman and as a kindly person. Then Anne Saddlemyr's poem that she read there actually, for me, opened a completely new world for Seamus. As Peter was saying, you cannot really separate Seamus into nice, neat packages. There is a lovely flow, a movement in his life. And I think what that is all about, she touched on very nicely there, is that he was upstairs in an attic. He was very much at home, very comforted in his nest, as he says it. And then suddenly this skylight comes in, and his comfort is taken away from him. And out of it comes a whole new series of work, which he eventually calls Seeing Things. And he moves again from the comfort zone in which he occasionally fell out into the big broad world all over again. And this is the way Seamus moved always. So it is exciting. It has been exciting to follow Seamus, because you never knew exactly what he was going to be doing next. And therefore, the loss to all of us is ever the greater.
Joining me on the line now as well from the United States is fellow poet Paul Muldoon, fellow Northern Irish poet Paul Muldoon, himself a winner of the Pulitzer Prize for poetry and the T.S. Eliot Prize. Paul, you might associate with John F. Dean's story there about being a young upstart and going to Seamus Heaney for some advice. You pressed or posted a sheaf of poetry into his hands. Is this right?
I'm afraid I did, as a 16-year-old, and needless to say, with all the grace and generosity that to which we've all become accustomed, Seamus, rather than tell me to take a running jump, which is what he could easily have done and maybe should have done, was very, very kind and had a look at the poems and was a great champion, as he was of so many poets. Not only people like myself who were, I suppose, in some sense, strictly pupils of his. I mean, I say strictly in the sense that I was literally a pupil of his at Queen's University, Belfast. But also, I think, his people of his own generation, to whom he was kind of unfailingly generous. It's very hard, I suppose, to talk about Seamus at all without running the risk of seeming somehow desperately pious about such things. But the fact of the matter is, as I'm sure everyone in your studio will attest, is that as a person as well as a poet, he was just unbeatable, you know?
What about the fact that both of you being Northern poets, was there a particular affiliation there? And what effect would you say that had, that you knew that he was in some way from the same landscape as yourself?
Well, that's right. But I mean, in that sense, Ireland is a very small place. And I don't know if even then we made all that much of the fact that we were from the north. The truth is that we come from just a few miles from each other, but then the further truth is that we all come from much the same place, even those in the north where for whom there's, I guess, a much more generally accepted schism or divide. The truth is that we're much more akin than we are removed from one another. And I think that's one of the things that comes across in Seamus's poems. I mean, I think of a poem, for example, like The Other Side, which describes a Protestant, quote-unquote, neighbour coming round of an evening to visit while the rosary is being said in the Catholic household, and all the tact and the discretion, the standing back, And the sense of respect that the neighbour shows, which frankly are all of those being qualities that Seamus himself had in to an exceptional degree.
Being a northern poet, he had to at some point face into writing about the politics of the North. How do you think that manifested itself in his work?
Well, there are fairly obvious points. I mean, first of all, I think it was inevitable for all of us, frankly, for many part of the island, that this particular strife, conflagration, the campaign of terror, however we want to describe it, and we shy away from some of these descriptions, of course, these days. That was part of our lives, and it was part of our lives not only in the North but in the South, and indeed in the UK, and maybe even in the US of A. So in a sense, it was more or less incumbent on one and all as citizens, never mind as writers or poets, to try to make sense of things. But of course, one of the jobs of the poet is to do just that, and Seamus, I think, found many ways of being equal to the complexity of that situation. And I think one of his most signal accomplishments is to remind himself, and indeed the rest of us, of the complexity of it all. He always resisted anything that smacked of propaganda. He always resisted valorizing one side over the other. There were moments, of course, when he may have, to state a case at all, may have overstated it. I'm thinking of that occasion when he made clear to the editors of the Penguin Book of Contemporary British Poetry that British was not necessarily a term that he would entirely welcome. And he mentions, of course, the fact that in his household, no glass was ever raised to the Queen. I think one of the great things about Seamus Heaney and about his position in Ireland and Irish poetry, indeed world poetry, was that, of course, when Queen Elizabeth came to visit Dublin, he was right there at the top table and probably raising a glass with herself. And I think that in a way is an indication of his ability, and indeed all of our general ability, to move with the times and to allow that things have changed, that things can change, and to be equal to the moment as the moment goes to the next moment.
You have chosen the poem, Paul, Follower, from that debut collection, Death of a Naturalist. Why that particular poem? What is important about it for you?
You know, I think one of the things that struck me as a teenager about Seamus, first of all, with that first book, Death of a Naturalist, which, of course, we read at the time and which had an immediate impact on all of us. John F. Dean rightly says that Kavanagh, Hopkins, are part of the same line, Wordsworth to a significant extent. But the fact of the matter was that for me, certainly, I wasn't familiar at that point with Kavanagh and nor Hopkins in any significant way. And I was struck by the fact that there was someone who was writing about the things of the world as even I knew them. For example, ploughing with a horse. When one of my earliest memories is of being stepped on by a horse. And the fact that Seamus Heaney could write poems about horses, frogs, all the impedimenta, the bits and pieces of the world that we recognized, however banal this may sound, was actually, I mean, terrifically inspirational and gave one the sense, I mean, put very crudely, as we've seen in so many other areas of life, the sense, well, there's a guy from up the road, he's doing that. Well, actually, maybe the rest of us could have a go at that too. So I think there was a leavening aspect about Seamus from the outset that he allowed for the possibility not only of himself making sense of the world, but of others taking part in the same pursuit through poetry.
Let's hear then Follower from Death of a Naturalist.
Follower. My father worked with a horse plough, his shoulders globed like a full sail strung between the shafts and the furrow. The horses strained at his clicking tongue. An expert, he would set the wing and fit the bright steel-pointed sock. The sod rolled over without breaking. At the head rig, with a single pluck of reins, the sweating team turned round and back into the land. His eye narrowed and angled at the ground, mapping the furrow exactly. I stumbled in his hobnailed wake, fell sometimes on the polished sod. Sometimes he rode me on his back, dipping and rising to his plod. I wanted to grow up and plough, to close one eye, stiffen my arm. All I ever did was follow in his broad shadow round the farm. I was a nuisance, tripping, falling, yapping always. But today, it is my father who keeps stumbling behind me and will not go away.
Follower from Seamus Heaney's debut collection, Death of a Naturalist, at the choice of Paul Muldoon. You're listening to an extended arena programme commemorating the life and work of Seamus Heaney, who died earlier today. Joining me now on the telephone line is Michael Longley, fellow poet, whose life and career, I suppose, in some ways, Michael, have intertwined with that of Seamus Heaney in many ways. You said today that you were rereading his early poems and they struck you as miracles. Was this the appreciation of his work something that you could share with Seamus? Could you actually tell him that type of thing?
Oh, he was a human being who responded to stimuli. And one of the most important stimuli is praise. And I know that he was delighted when I said that. We were waiting to go on stage in the festival hall, and I whispered that to him. And he said, well, the poems came from Balakhi, he joked, so there had to be miracles. But I think that's true. I think myself, I slightly underrated the early poems, but they are absolutely wonderful, and they have the true light in them. You know, like a Vermeer or a Rembrandt. They catch the light. Their surfaces catch the light. And we read together just a fortnight ago today, so I'm really rather overwhelmed, you'll understand.
Mm.
We read together in Listoun Varna, and it was an extraordinarily happy occasion. And after the reading, we the four of us, Edna and Mary and Seamus and I and a few other friends, we sat round a table in the hotel and had some nightcaps, and I wrote a card after this to them both, saying that the sole power of our duet and the warm conversation that I'd had with Mary on the sofa, the warm confabulation, had been completely renovating and thrilling, and that I loved them both, and I call them old chums, and I'm very glad now, sadly glad that I sent that card. We've known each other more than 50 years. We met about 63 or 64. And, of course, we go our separate ways, and we sang from our separate bushes. And but nevertheless, it was a long, long and lasting friendship.
I know that performance that you speak about was at the Merriman Summer School in Clare, just, as you say, a fortnight ago. How important was that? The fact that we're listening tonight on that wonderful 15 CD box set that we have of Seamus reading all of the collections practically up until the most recent one, how important was that aspect of the poetry to him, actually reading it and performing it to a public who were listening, not just reading?
He was a very good reader. I myself believe that poetry is launched from the mouth and finds its resting place in the ear, and that we must forget that poetry existed long before alphabets and writing, and it has to be read aloud. So I loved listening to Seamus reading with his gravelly, lilting voice. And I was looking very carefully at the audience when Seamus was reading his poems, and their faces were lit up, and he was getting through to, I think it was about 300 people, but he was getting through to 300 individuals, and that's because of the way he reads with them. With great modesty, but with a gravitas as well. It was a wonderful evening. I really loved it.
Moya Cannon is in our Galway studios at the moment. Moya, you've chosen the poem "Markings" from the collection "Seeing Things." Before we listen to that poem, do you that sort of expression that Michael had there of hearing Seamus read his own work? Have you experienced that yourself, and experienced that feeling of being the one person he was reading to? Because I know certainly many people in this studio probably have had that feeling.
I must say, today, just hearing his voice over and over again today, you're made just so aware. It reminds me of something he said himself in an early essay, where he talked about influence of somebody's voice entering your ear, into your brain space, and just exciting your whole nervous system. And there's something about the way he gets right into you, which is pretty unique, I think.
And when would his work have started to become important to you as a young poet, Moya?
Oddly enough, perhaps I shouldn't confess this, I came to Seamus Heaney's work later than I should have, probably, and I came to it through the prose. The first time I was absolutely blown away by Preoccupations. I think until then, it's very odd how you will read a poet and not awaken to him. I find that very often with poets whose work I come to love dearly, that you have to be ready for them. And I said I fell in love first with Preoccupations and then with the poetry.
Preoccupations was the selected prose that was published in 1980.
I think a bit maybe a little earlier than that. Perhaps was it as late as 80? I thought it was earlier, possibly. And I absolutely loved the elegance of the prose, and I think I became aware at that point of the extraordinary tensions in his work, which animated the tensions between the sort of the way in which he has a courage to integrate the colloquial and the vernacular, and yet, you know, with Greek mythology in an absolutely seamless way, in a way which actually reanimates and breathes life into the mythology as well.
Indeed, you're right that the prose were between 1968 and 78, but I think they were published as a collection then a little later. How then, and how does that fit into the poem that you've chosen for us, Markings? Does it have a quality of the prose in it, or what is it that particularly speaks to you in this poem?
I love it because of the tensions which it describes. I was just, I opened Preoccupations again today, and I was looking, just the very, very first essay, he talks about Wordsworth, he quotes Wordsworth's Prelude, where Wordsworth speaks about the hiding places of my power. And I said, well, what are the hiding places of Heaney's power? And I think one of the things is just absolute tension, the way he sort of entertains, I said, the tension between the earthy and, I said, the elegant, the tension between the head, the heart and the spirit. The way the strain of this comes across in this particular poem, where he talks about a group of boys And it's like a tiny little film clip, I think. You know, he talks about youngsters, you know, which dates it already. You know, before we were teenagers or adolescents, we were all youngsters playing football in the field at evening. And he talks about the straight lines which they drew in their heads, you know, as they were marking out a field for football. He said all of us there, just four jackets, and many people will remember seeing or participating in those games. And I think he may be talking about this, just the structures, the necessary structure of a poem, perhaps the necessary structure of a life, and how we do need to draw out the lines, and yet how life will always flow above and beyond them, and we're carried on by rhythm. I mean, he talks about the a limit past where there's fleetness, furtherance, untiredness in a time that was extra, unforeseen, and free. And he later talks about, you know, a mower mowing through a meadow at the end of it, and you know, he's mowing a sea of corn. And he also talks about the again, a total contradiction of somebody with a windlass and a bucket pulling a circle out of water. And I love, I say, the tension between those abstract straight lines, which are necessary in our lives in many ways, and, as I say, the real life, which flows outside it. And I think that that was one of the hiding places of his power, you know. He said somewhere else, I mean, another of his poems, which I love, is Keeping Going, where and I was thinking of that today as well, you know, how he kept going till the end. Keeping Going is a poem in honour of his brother, who lived through the worst of the Troubles, and how he was keeping going even when his health wasn't very good.
Yes.
And, but he says, you know, on the one hand, he says, you know, poetry is secret and natural, and on the other hand, it must make its way in a world that's public and brutal. And I think that tension was one of the hiding places of his power.
Well, we'll go back to the poem with the youngsters in it, as you say, and markings from seeing things, read by Seamus Heaney.
Markings. 1. We marked the pitch. Four jackets for four goalposts. That was all. The corners and the squares were there like longitude and latitude under the bumpy, thistly ground, to be agreed about or disagreed about when the time came. And then we picked the teams and crossed the line our called names drew between us. Youngsters shouting their heads off in a field as the light died, and they kept on playing because by then they were playing in their heads, and the actual kicked ball came to them like a dream heaviness. And their own hard breathing in the dark and skids on grass sounded like effort in another world. It was quick and constant, a game that never need be played out. Some limit had been passed. There was fleetness, furtherance, untiredness in time that was extra, unforeseen, and free. 2. You also loved lines pegged out in the garden, the spade nicking the first straight edge along the tight white string, or string stretched perfectly to mark the outline of a house foundation, pale timber batten set at right angles for every corner, each freshly sawn new board spick and span in the oddly passive grass, or the imaginary line straight down a field of grazing, to be ploughed open from the rod stuck in one head rig to the rod stuck in the other. 3. All these things entered you as if they were both the door and what came through it. They marked the spot, marked time, and held it open. A mower parted the bronze sea of corn. A windlass hauled the centre out of water. Two men with a cross cut kept it swimming into a felled beach backwards and forwards, so that they seemed to row the steady earth.
Markings from Seamus Heaney, Seeing Things, and it's this evening on Arena we are commemorating the Nobel laureate and his life and work. With me in studio, we'll be speaking to them shortly. Evelyn O'Rourke has been going through the archive recordings of Seamus Heaney himself speaking in interview, and also Tim Lahan, the man who produced the collection of recordings that we have been listening to over the last 45 minutes and will continue to do so over the next 45 minutes and still hear poets Pat Boran and Enda Wiley. So stay tuned for more.
RTE Radio 1.
RTE remembers the 1913 lockout.
The lockout, like every strike, had a beginning, and as it had a beginning, it of course had to have an end. But when it ended, what would happen to those who went on strike? Would they be able to find work in the city? Many were, or at least some were, but others were not. So what became of them? This issue was grappled with quite brilliantly by James Plunkett in Strumpet City. And in an extremely moving and emotional scene at the end of the book, the hero of the book, Fitz, is leaving Dublin on a ship, having joined the British Army to fight in World War I. In doing this, he did what 250,000 other Irishmen did, 30,000 of whom died. He paints a picture of being on the ship, leaving the Black Lighthouse, the bells tinkling remotely in the air, the lights of the city, Ireland slipping away, and before the soldiers lying England and training camps, and beyond that the continent, foreign tongues, unfamiliar countries, shattered towns, war.
The 1913 lockout on RTE Radio 1.
As a nation, we've been broke many times, yet we remain one of the most generous countries in history. But how do we continue to be so generous when we feel we can't give anymore? When we all give the same.
The 1% difference. 1% of your time or money to a cause you believe in. Visit 1percentdifference.ie.
If you want to avoid being fleeced by lamb or soured by milk,
ew,
don't get caught out by out-of-date food. Always eat it or freeze it by its use-by date, and you'll never get caught out again.
Ow.
Supported by the EPA. Find more ways to cut food waste at safefood.eu.
The word is out. This year's Mountains to See DLR Book Festival will be a bestseller. The setting is Dunleary, the theme is family-orientated, and the many characters that will be there include Margaret Atwood, Colin McCann, Richard and Judy, Charlie Hickson, Tommy Tiernan, and Michael Harding. Enjoy readings, poetry, workshops, and there's lots for families, including a picture book picnic and monster book lunch. Mountains to See DLR Book Festival, September 3rd to 8th. See mountainstosee.ie for details.
11 minutes to 8 o'clock on this Friday evening. Today is the day that we lost Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney, and this evening on Arena we're with you through until 8:30, commemorating the life and work of Seamus Heaney. Right throughout his career, he regularly contributed and even presented programmes here on RTE Radio 1, and Evelyn O'Rourke has been going through some of his earlier archived broadcasts. Evelyn, we begin with an excerpt from an interview that Seamus did with John Quinn on a programme called I Remember, I Remember. This was broadcast over 30 years ago in 1981. And I'm just going to start by listening to that. And John asked him to share his first ever memory with him.
My first sense of myself on the planet, I think, my first memory. I'm not sure whether I remember it or whether people talking about it to me has given me a picture of it. But I was lost one afternoon when I was a youngster. I suppose it must have been three. I don't know what age it would have been. My mother was worried about me, and they came upon me in the middle of a pea rig, a rig of peas among the rods, hidden. I like to think of that as a kind of, almost an image of the womb itself, the green veins all around you. And I think when she found me, I was crying, so that's another image of of the moment of birth. But I don't know, I suppose it's a warmish, balmy element that you move in for a good while as a kid, just close to parents. The smell of clothes and the smell of adult bodies.
Seamus Heaney there talking to John Quinn on the Radio 1 programme I Remember, I Remember, and that recording was made on the 25th of June 1981. Evelyn O'Rourke has, as I said, been going through the archives. Amazing that his voice, that how long ago is that, 30 years more at this stage, his voice sounds exactly the same even 30 years later.
It's fascinating, having spent the afternoon listening back to him, going back right over the years. That really struck me. The second thing that struck me forcibly, Sean, was how generous he was with his time, because there were so many contributions to to pick from. And in fairness, he was always extremely enthusiastic when we got in touch with him and very well prepared when he agreed to appear. So I really was spoiled for choice. But with this programme, I remember, it's a particularly charming programme, I think. And I decided to go for another clip with it there, where he talks to John Quinn about writing. And obviously, a lot of writers talk about the fact that they started at a young age. With Seamus Heaney, he utterly rejects this. And it's funny at first, but then he goes on to give a very interesting notion and idea and theory about the stifled atmosphere of a classroom and how that can stifle creativity. So it's quite a powerful piece in many ways.
Did you make any early attempts at writing at all yourself, I mean, in your school days or early teens?
Not the slightest, no, never. I was particularly stilted, I think, indeed. I mean, I think the kind of system that I came in under in the first school I was at was that you tried to write as much like everybody else as possible, you know. I mean, remember the old exercises, I'm sure you had them in school too, the similes, you know, as brave as. And the correct answer was a lion, you know. You didn't want to get too original because you were wrong then. And this all came clear to me quite recently when I remembered, like, what happened to me at the seaside. If I were given an essay to do on the seaside, which we frequently were, you told a bundle of lies, you know. But that was what writing was to you, writing up the formal thing that everybody else said, that you went to the seaside, that you looked, that you swam, I never could swim, that you bought a bucket and spade and played sandcastles. Now, I never had a bucket and spade in my life. My mother actually bought me a wooden spoon once to put the rat in the sand, and then she could take it home and work with it. I think that nowadays, if you had a good English teacher, they would probably have you in a situation where you would actually write down, you know, I went to the seaside and Mammy got me a wooden spoon, which I didn't learn you could tell the truth in writing until my 20s, and in a way that's why I started to write, you know. Didn't trust, if you like, my own experience.
A beautiful clip there of Seamus Heaney talking to John Quinn on the programme I Remember, it's 25th of June 1981. Evelyn O'Rourke has been choosing these clips for us and listening to a lot of stuff throughout the day, I know, Evelyn. In this third and final clip, you're bringing us forward to 1995, and this was a big news day in the Heaney house.
Well, it was a big news day for people in Ireland, but Seamus Heaney was on his holidays in Greece and they weren't able to track him down because obviously it was slightly pre-mobile phone and email. But Tommy Gorman managed to track him down. And in this interview, it sounds like it's conducted on the roadside in Greece. You can actually hear motorbikes racing by and the two men have a wonderful conversation. At one point, Seamus Heaney even kind of recites when all the others were away at mass, or the potato peeling poem, as I heard it referred to affectionately earlier today. So it really is a wonderful piece of archive, but here he talks about the reaction to the news and how he feels about getting this award.
I had no inkling at all, and I had planned this holiday for a long time. We were, so to speak, out of contact with home for about 4 or 5 days, and we came then to this little hotel in a place called Pylos. We gave ourselves a day of rest, so I rang home, Christopher's son at home, and he said, did you hear? I said, no. He said, you've won the Nobel Prize. I said, come on. And he said, no. And this was Friday afternoon, and the news had come in on Thursday, apparently.
Could you believe it when you heard it?
No, it's just entirely bewildering, and it's still a bit incredible. It's an awesome dimension of a thing to have happened, you know. So,
you are considered a poet of ordinary people and also an Irish poet.
Scribes are always a bit wary of tributes and of adjectives, you know. Irish poet can have a certain caricature aspect to it. But at a moment like this, that kind of language is celebratory, and in that context, you do rejoice in it. All you have to work with as a writer is your sense of the world. And my sense of the world was given to me within a certain community, with a certain set of values, within a northern context, which was, we might call, a pluralist one, within a family that had a terrific realism and a terrific truth about it. There was something in the family I grew up in and in the community I grew up in, a thoroughness and a straightforwardness, a dedication to the unphony, which I cherish.
That's Seamus Heaney there on the day that he heard about his winning of the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1995 on, as Evelyn O'Rourke told us, on the side of a road in Greece somewhere. With me is Tim Lahan, as I said, who is the man who is responsible for the recording of the Seamus Heaney Collected Poems and RTE production in connection in collaboration with the Lannan Foundation. Even listening to him there, Tim, he just knew how to tell a story. The minute you asked him to say what happened, he could turn it into a story.
He certainly could do that. And just the sheer act of listening to him, even if, let's say for argument's sake, that you didn't fully understand the references in the poem, but it was just that wonderful flow of words, and words so well chosen. From my point of view in recording this, it was absolutely a wonderful experience. You know, I would have paid gold for just to do. But it was also fascinating and interesting for me for this reason. There's stuff that I have marked in some of these books that I had for the readings, which you will not know about in the actual yes. discs themselves. So, for example, if there are any Heaney fans, I'll just tell you what he said after one of the poems from Wintering Out. He said, "It's one of those that could be struck from the register, but there's nothing we can do about it now."
So as he read through the poems with you, first of all, how long did this take you? Because there were many collections.
It took several months because there were 11
collections at that point.
And obviously when you're getting somebody to read, you can't get them reading from 8 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night, because it only takes a couple of hours to suddenly the voice becomes tired and it becomes very audible. And then if you're trying to match that voice with what you're picking up with tomorrow morning, it's just going to sound terrible on the disc, you know? So we had to shepherd his voice. Seamus himself had to shepherd his voice, if you know what I mean.
And were there situations where the poem was read and it was pretty much one take? Or was there a lot
there were several poems that were one take. There were several other poems that were several takes. But Seamus was so easy to work with. Do you know what I mean? When I started this, you're dealing with like somebody who doth bestride the world like a colossus, like in terms of his iconic status and stuff like that. And a lot of people who have that sort of status, you don't know whether they're going to be, they're going to be irritable and they're going to be dismissive and all that stuff. Mm. Seamus was such a gentleman, and his idea was, let's get this right. So if there was something that I maybe found, I'd say, maybe Seamus, that stanza maybe could be taken a little bit slower or something like that. He certainly, yeah. Absolutely, no problem.
You've also have another marking there.
Yes,
in
I
your
have.
Book.
And can I tell you that in the spirit level, we came and he recorded the poem, A Call, which I love. And I said to him after the poem, Seamus, I really like that poem. To which he said, maybe the best poem in the book. So it's those little things that...
And you actually, I see you have
that
written
down. I wrote it
down.
In pencil immediately. I wrote it because otherwise I would have...
You'd never remember
I would have quite forgotten it. There's one here where he...
What collection is this?
This one now I'm going to quote is from District and Circle. And it's from a poem called Wordsworth Skates. And he said, having read the line, but the reel of them on frozen Windermere, that's the line, okay, and that's just near the end. And he says, when he had read it, that's a total factual mistake. It was Ullswater, but it's too late now.
Great stories.
And then he added in just quite about Wordsworth. He was a great skater, the same boy.
About William Wordsworth. Well, listen, we will no doubt listen to more of those tales as we go towards 8:30. 8:05, and you're listening to Arena. For those of you expecting John Creedon at this point in time, John will be with you at 8:30 this evening. We are here on Arena having an extended programme commemorating Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney, who died earlier today. Some of the tweets that have been coming into the programme at RTE Arena. Owen says that he was at that reading in Listoon, Varna. Michael Longley was talking about it earlier on as part of the Merryman Summer School a fortnight ago tonight. And Owen's tweet says, I remember the way Longley kissed Heaney at the end of the reading, a truly beautiful gesture. Ciara O'Sullivan is loving the bits that she's hearing. Thanks for making sure he's commemorated. Gillian Flynn says, Michael Longley speaks of Seamus's poetry as having the true light like Vermeer or Rembrandt. So true, she says. And Matt Bowden tweeted to say, Heaney made otherwise drab rural scenes meaningful, life meaningful, a fully creative human being lost. Some great commemorative quotes there for sure. Joining me now from London is Matthew Hollis, the poetry editor of Faber and Faber. Matthew, the line that strikes me particularly from those tweets is Gillian Flynn quoting back to Michael Longley, referring to Seamus Heaney's poetry as having the true light like a Vermeer or like Rembrandt. It does describe what he managed to do with words.
It does, and it's interesting that the theme of light should come up, because it's the one word I found myself going back to again and again today, because there was something about either being in Seamus's presence or even just being in the presence of his poetry that he seemed to bring the light with him, it seemed to me, and that you could see further when you stood beside Seamus or when you read the poems on the page from Seamus. There was something about his gift in the phrasing that allowed you to see that little bit further out into the gloom of what lies out there in life.
You've been listening to his poetry throughout the day today. Did you choose to listen rather than to read?
I love to hear him read. He's such an exquisite reader and articulator of his own work, and I think Seamus reminds us all of that intimate link between the ear and the eye in poetry and the oral tradition of storytelling, of which we all feel very important that we stay a big part, especially in such a busy day and busy life.
I don't know if you heard Tim Lahan talking before news about those little notes that he made at the bottom of the page of the poems as Seamus was reading them for the CD set that he recorded. But it was one point where Seamus was correcting an item that he felt, I got that factually wrong. What is the relationship for somebody like yourself, an editor at Faber and Faber, with a poet like Seamus Heaney?
Well, I think it's fair to say that I don't think Seamus needed any help from me when it came to bringing his poems together. I would say rather the other way around, that I learn how to read through poets like Seamus. And for so many of us and so many of your listeners, Seamus will be possibly the first poet we ever read. And I remember as a teenager first coming across Seamus's poetry, and I remember that thrill of a new book coming out and running to the shops to get it. And I think that thrill of the new is one of the things that I've learned most from working with Seamus, that it always stays new, and he has this gift to make it feel as if it's always an event, and that a line, a simple movement of a line of type from one side of the page to the other, could be such a thrill and could be such a new moment. That's something that I learn and relearn and renew every time I read Seamus's work.
I was earlier today, I was watching Out of the Marvellous, the Charlie McCarthy documentary, which incidentally, for those who are interested, will be rebroadcast tonight on RT1 Television at 25 to 11. And in that film, we actually see him going to Faber and Faber, the Faber and Faber offices, and he's remembering his first time going there, which was, I think, was it the day after he was married?
That's the story. And it's certainly true that at Faber, we could not be more proud to publish Seamus Heaney, and have done so for nearly 50 years. And I have to say, I've just left the building, and the corridors there have been filled with tears all day long. The love for this man in our company there seems to know no bounds, and it's hard to think of Faber without Seamus.
Do you think of him as an Irish poet or as an international poet, Matthew?
Well, I think the answer must surely be both. I mean, W.H. Auden described the ideal for a poet being similar to a good valley cheese, that he was local but prized everywhere. And I think Seamus had that extraordinary gift to take people along with him, but to reach out so close as you could touch him. And many of the comments that I've received today, and I've been taking messages from poets all over the world, from New Zealand, from Britain, from the States, is that sense of someone that is both local and international, and someone, the amount of stories about seeing him sitting in the corner of a pub or a restaurant, and just being one of the people around him, you know, not above them in any sense. And I think that's one of his great gifts. It's surely one of his great gifts, and it's one of the reasons why we all feel so close to the poet through the poetry, and why it travels so far across the world at the very same time.
You chose the poem for us to listen to this evening from the Seeing Things collection, and the poem was actually entitled Seeing Things 3. Why this particular poem, Matthew?
Well, it's just a personal memory from a reading that I was doing with Seamus in Dublin in May. We were celebrating the work of Denis O'Driscoll, and Seamus read from this from the book and read this poem that night. And you were asking earlier about newness and freshness, and I was so struck that this collection that was published in the early 90s, this poem sounded brand new and the paint seemed still drying. It seemed so alive and so animate, and it brought across his storytelling so well and his gift for line and gift for near, and I think that was probably why I wanted to choose it. And also because I suppose it reminded me of something that I think of a lot when I think of Seamus's work, that as a writer and as a reader, I feel lucky and privileged to have lived in a time in which Seamus Heaney was writing. I think to have had him writing in our era is something that is a joyous gift and should be a source of happiness, and it will be for a very, very long time to come.
Matthew Hollis, poetry editor of Faber and Faber, thank you for speaking with us this evening on the poem that Matthew wants us to listen to, Seeing Things Three.
Three. Once upon a time, my undrowned father walked into our yard. He had gone to spray potatoes in a field on the riverbank and wouldn't bring me with him. The horse sprayer was too big and newfangled. Bluestone might burn me in the eyes. The horse was fresh. I might scare the horse, and so on. I threw stones at a bird in the shed roof, as much for the clatter of the stones as anything. But when he came back, I was inside the house and saw him out the window, scatter-eyed and daunted, strange, without his hat, his step unguided, his ghosthood imminent. When he was turning on the riverbank, the horse had rusted and reared up and pitched cart and sprayer and everything off balance. So the whole rig went over into a deep whirlpool. Hoofs, chains, shafts, cartwheels, barrel and tackle, all tumbling off the world. And the hat already merrily swept along the quieter reaches. That afternoon, I saw him face to face. He came to me with his damp footprints out of the river, and there was nothing between us there that might not still be happily ever after.
Seeing Things 3 from the collection Seeing Things by Seamus Heaney. In our Cork studio at the moment is Thomas McCarthy. Thomas, what was your own connection with Seamus Heaney?
First, as a reader, I think the effect of reading him, you know, when I was in my 20s was just, it's difficult to describe it now. You knew that something different had happened to the same material. I mean, it was very familiar material, as people have said, but, you know, it wasn't the material that people were kind of using the tawny, guttural water of an individual kind of word music. Heaney had his own word music, and I think it was the distinctiveness, not just his way of saying things, but his way of seeing things, that was so amazing.
Matthew Hollis was talking to us about the tears in the corridors of Faber and Faber today. You work in a library in Cork, and I believe there was quite a reaction in the building today as well.
Absolutely. People couldn't believe it at first. Then people began to talk about their memories of first reading him. People talking about bringing a book of his abroad when they'd be going abroad, emigrating, or giving one of his books to their child when they were going abroad as sort of most kind of honest memento of our country. And that to me is probably what Seamus Heaney really, really means to people. There was nothing sort of elitist, yet he was an absolutely elite craftsman. But he was really like an absolutely brilliant potter, I think, a craftsman. You know, all could drink from what he was making. And I think that everybody feels that. I mean, even people were thrilled when we exhibited all the books we had in stock of his, you know, in the library, so they could see all of his books when they came in the door. We just simply had his name and the dates of his life. And it was a moving day. It reminds me actually of the day he won the Nobel Prize. I'll always remember an elderly man coming in and I said to him, did you hear about Heaney? And he said, oh God, what's happened? And I said, no, he's won the Nobel Prize. I remember the man stepping back from the desk of the library and taking off his hat and bowing and said, God bless them Swedes. And I think it was that, this is that kind of a day too, something that has happened which affects us nationally, you know, affects us as a people. But also it's actually a tectonic shift in all who share the English language.
With me and sitting patiently since since 7 o'clock, in fact, are both Pat Bourne and Enda Wiley. So I should ask you at this point, Pat, first of all, what Thomas is talking about there, it is a tectonic shift. Now, not, Heaney's poetry was that, but is today a tectonic shift in another direction? What have we lost?
We have lost a great champion of poetry apart from anything else. I mean, Dennis O'Driscoll was mentioned there earlier, and Dennis and Seamus cooperated on that extraordinary book, Stepping Stones, which is kind of a biography and a bibliography and an exploration of the power of the craft of Heaney's work. And Dennis was something of that as well. But, you know, Seamus has in a way, apart from his own power, his fabulous power as a writer and his vision as a writer, because of this great generosity, it is a situation where this boat, if you like, has raised all boats around it. And I would be very fearful now that sense of that power, a power is passing from the earth into nature's dark abyss, that it would take off the interest in poetry that is in this island. I think Seamus reminded us that this is a tradition we have that goes way, way back. It goes back in both languages. And he drew on those and he brought in all those other strains and threads from outside. In a way, he kind of married the tradition that Kavanagh was the most recent heir to, which was a very earthy, very gritty tradition, to this somewhat more visionary tradition that came through Wordsworth, as mentioned earlier, and others. And he went, of course, much further afield, and he went back into the Greek myth, etc. But he was all about refreshing and remaking and about seeing. And it's amazing how many people have mentioned Seeing Things as one of the key collections. And John F. Dean, who's sitting beside me, has it here in front of him, yes, as well. It is a key collection, and in a sense it explains part of what Heaney did. He made things new and fresh, and he made you, as somebody said, he made you see things you thought you already knew and might have overlooked, the fact of being out in a furrow, and that this wasn't suitable or of enough elevation for poetry, that he gave things and he gave people that license to see the poetry in things.
And it was, I think it was Moya Cannon who said to us earlier on, Enda, while you're speaking with me now, the head, the heart and the spirit were the three things that he managed to marry together. What was your first connection with him as a poet? Because you must have been a very young poet when you first came across him.
Well, yeah, I remember as a child, even my mother, my parents are both great readers, coming home from Trinity full of excitement because she'd heard a poet called James Heaney, and all the students just clapping and roaring with excitement. And I remember taking her book Fieldwork and having a route through it. But I was lucky enough, when I was about 19, I did a very bold thing, a bit like Paul Muldoon. And I remember cycling on my bike down to Dunleary. I'd heard that Seamus Heaney and Derek Walcott were there reading, and I stood on the grass in the Royal Marine Hotel with a brown envelope with my poems in it. And then he finally turned around and said, "What have we here?" And I explained that I had my poems, and he just took the envelope away, and I was mortified at having done that. But a week later, my younger brother came running into the sitting room and said, Enda, Seamus Heaney's on the phone. And I just thought he was joking, and turned out no, he was indeed. And he asked me to his house for tea, and I was only about 19 or 20, and he read through the poems. And I mean, people have been saying so many words about him today, and it's been a devastating day. But when I think of him, I think of the humour, the generosity. I mean, that he asked me over to his house and gave me his Ted Hughes collection, Elizabeth Bishop, because as so many people have said here tonight, he was committed to the world of poetry, not just to his own poetry, but to the reading of other poets. And another poet that I always think of when I think of Seamus is Ted Hughes. And I actually remember him saying that day, "Would you like to meet Ted? He comes here fishing a lot." And so he was hugely encouraging to young poets. And so I suppose on and off over the past 20 years, I've always encountered him on a personal level. But also Matthew Hollis was using the word thrill. Absolute thrill to meet Seamus, to get the wink, the hug. But the biggest thrill of all was to read his work and just feel that shiver down your spine, yeah, when he got it right more than anybody else. And somebody used the word unbeatable, unbeatable. If there's a competition of poets, he wins hands down. So we've lost a great man and a great poet today.
Also on the phone at the moment is a fellow poet friend and professor of English literature at Trinity College, Gerald Daw. Gerald, you refer to, which picks up in lots of ways what Enda Wiley was just saying to us, you refer to Seamus as it's like being an older brother to you. What influence did he have, or what encouragement did he give you as a writer?
Well, I mean, just being in his company was inspiration enough. He was the kind of man that he allowed you to express your opinions even when you hadn't really made them, hadn't formed them properly. And he always struck me as being someone who was a great entertainer and encourager of other people's ideas and so on. And I mean, the intelligence that's at play at the poetry in his own poems, I mean, is second to none. The reading that he brought to his writing, and I think someone just has already mentioned the sheer love of poetry that he had. I mean, it's unimaginable to see him go, that void is going to take a lot. It cannot be filled. But there was also, I mean, the value and the marvel of the poems seemed to be of universal value. The way in which he could bring together local idiom and this huge reading that he brought from Europe, from people like Czesław Miłosz and his friend Joseph Brodsky. Being with Seamus is almost like being in an aircraft called poetry. I mean, you just didn't know where it was going to land. And the twinkle in the eye, which Enda's just mentioned, I mean, there was also this extraordinary ability to withstand those who disagreed with him who had a different political view of the value of poetry than he had. That copiousness is there in the work. But it all comes out of, I think, this instinctive, intuitive feeling for language and the understanding that poetry actually is not something that sits in a museum. It doesn't sit on a bookshelf. It's actually a creative part of living.
Some of the tweets and messages that have been coming into us here. Phil McDermott tweeted, two words I always associated with Seamus Heaney, kindness and wisdom. I think in his case, those words mean the same thing. And Jennifer Ryan says she's listening to our tribute to Heaney on in the background as she potters at the moment. Not so much to hear what's being said, but just to be part of paying respect. And I guess lots of people will want to be part of that, as indeed that's the very reason we're doing this programme this evening. Rita Ann Higgins' poet is in our Galway studio. And rather like Enda Wiley, Rita, you had an invitation back to the Heaney household at one point as well. How did that actually happen?
I was reading in Dunleary at the Poetry Now Festival, as it was called at the time, and we were all invited back, all the people who attended the festival. I can only remember John McAuliffe I remember others, but I remember being talking to John McAuliffe and saying, God, this is amazing, and this is such a lovely gesture. But Seamus and Mary were just so wonderful. They were just so generous and kind to us. And, you know, and Michael Longley was there. And Michael and Seamus always have this divilment going on between them. And I found myself in the kitchen between the two of them and two of the daughters of Susie Kennelly, Seamus's PA, and her daughters were being photographed, and I was there with the two boys, and there was just absolutely great crack altogether. It was lovely. And he read at Coorch a month ago, or in April. It seems like a very long time ago, but it wasn't that long time at all. And he read again with Michael Longley, and the two of them together were just fantastic. And Michael, I had been talking to Mary before that, and she said that they had to leave very quickly afterwards, that they were going off to Dublin to their daughter's birthday. But I was talking to Michael Longley after the reading, and during the reading, Michael Longley read one of Michael D. Higgins's poems, because President Higgins was the guest of honour in the audience, and it was... So Michael Longley read one of Michael D's poems. And then when Seamus Heaney came on, after a while, he also read one of Michael D's poems. So I said to Michael Longley afterwards, did Seamus copy you reading the Michael D poem? And he said, not at all. It was Seamus's idea. So, you know, I felt so sad all day, and I wondered if I had the right to be that sad. You know, it's just that any minute, the few minutes that you were with him, 5 minutes or the 10 minutes or whatever you were with Seamus Heaney, he turned it around on you. It was your time and not his time, because he wasn't... You wanted to pay homage, but he didn't want the homage. He wanted that turned around
to you.
You know, he was extraordinary like that, and people mentioned his generosity all day. And he has also, without intending to do it, marked out a territory everywhere. I was in Clare in Fecal a few weeks ago, and I kept thinking of his postscript poem and the flaggy shore and when the wind and the light are working off each other, you know. So you're in another place and you're still thinking of him, and that was weeks ago. Nothing to do with today at all.
Of course, all of us have lost a great poet, and in some cases a friend, I guess, but people at home, his wife Mary, his children Michael, Christopher and Catherine Ann, have lost a husband and a father. And I know, Enda, that you chose the poem Skunk, and I think this is sort of a nice one in terms of that family connection.
Did, because I just think you can't think of Seamus Heaney without thinking of Mary, because she's such a strong force and a wonderful person and wife. And I chose the poem Skunk because it's a love letter to Mary. He wrote it in 1979, but he was thinking way back to 70, 71 when he spent time out in California. And people have described him as a rural poet, but he was also a highly sensual poet. And this poem, I just think there is a sense of fun and intimacy and sensuality there.